This is John Howell, Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Call it dark money at work. The story about how Cook County's only remaining Republican countywide official saved his job by about 3,000 votes. The official, Commissioner Sean Morrison, who also happens to be Cook County GOP chair. Greg wrote back in September about how $200,000 mysteriously appeared in his campaign fund. That was back in September. Originally, that was donated quite a while ago by Ken Griffin to a group opposed to Pritzker's graduated income tax. That was back in 2020. But then the cash was passed on to another group, the Coalition to Cut Taxes, who then donated it to Morrison. Now, they're not registered with the Illinois State Board of Elections. They don't have a big web presence, and Morrison said he's not sure why he was the beneficiary. Huh. That'll protest a little too much. But then a couple things happened, one of which is that another $100,000 donation from the Coalition to Cut Taxes arrived in Morrison's campaign coffers a day before the midterms. It wasn't reported until the day after we all voted, and it certainly helped Morrison, who won his race over the Democratic challenger by about 3,000 votes. While the Coalition to Cut Taxes isn't registered with the Elections Board, it is registered as a nonprofit with the Illinois Secretary of State. And the group's registered legal agent is Chicago attorney John Fogarty. Wow, how do I recognize that name? Oh, he's the same John Fogarty who's the general counsel for the Illinois Republican Party. Now let's welcome our guest, Reform for Illinois Executive Director, Alisa Kaplan, returning guest to WLS. Alisa, welcome back. Should it take somebody like Greg Hines and a forensic accounting that takes hours upon hours upon hours to figure out exactly who's donating to whom?
No, it's ridiculous, and we still don't know exactly what happened or who's pulling the strings here. Look, if you or I want to donate to a candidate's campaign, as long as it's over, say, $150, we have to give our name, we have to give our address, we have to give our occupation, so that if somebody wants to know who's trying to influence them through these contributions, they can look it up on the State Board of Elections site, they can look it up on our site, Reform for Illinois site, Illinois Sunshine, that has campaign finance information, and they can see that, you know, we made that donation, and all that information is just out there. But if you want to donate $300,000, like this organization did, you need an investigative journalist to try and find out what's going on with that money, and you still won't know by the end of it. So it's really a ridiculous problem that needs a solution.
Other states like California have adopted some laws to address these sorts of situations. Can we get it done here?
I would hope so. The problem is that both parties benefit from dark money, right? Both parties there are wealthy donors on both sides. There's deep-pocketed special interests on both sides. It used to be that the Republican Party benefited more from dark money, and so, you know, the Democrats were a bit more motivated. But now it's really a two-party issue. And so we really need someone. We need a champion in the state legislature who's going to say, enough is enough. We, you know, the public deserves to know who's trying to influence them, who's trying to get candidates elected, who's trying to shape the political landscape in Illinois. And we need decent disclosure laws that are going to allow them to do that. So the types of laws that they passed in California and several other states, they would require big donors, you know, above a certain amount, to disclose the original source of those funds. So if this money came from Ken Griffin, it would have to say that it came from Ken Griffin. If it came from some corporation, it would have to say that. We can do the same thing in Illinois.
We don't have time to get into this. I don't know if you saw the Daily Beast article today on Dick Uihlein and the huge amount of money that he's pouring into Arizona post-midterm election, or has previously as well. It's another forensic study, but very, very murky and Byzantine, trying to figure out who gave what to whom.
Yeah, you know, the Supreme Court's decisions over the past few decades have opened so many alternate channels to influencing the political system that it's become very hard, very easy for those types of actors to do it through dark channels, and very difficult for voters like you and me to trace the process. But there are, like I said, legislative solutions to this that can help disclose. And we're not talking about limiting any money here. We're not talking about limiting any speech here.
Right.
We're talking about asking donors to disclose large amounts of money that come through various conduits so that we don't need an investigative journalist to try to figure out what's going on, you know, and follow a trail of breadcrumbs that still has a chance of hitting a brick wall.
Right.
So that is possible. And I think that we should work on it in Illinois. There's no reason we can't have the same nice things that other states have.
Elisa, Citizens United determined that money equals speech. So that's done. That's behind us. That's the field that we play on at this point going forward. I would like to know who is giving the money, however.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are people who are trying to influence us and who have huge means of doing so. So we absolutely deserve to know who's trying to influence us. And we need new tools for these new types of systems that have arisen in the wake of Citizens United and other cases.
Elisa Kaplan, Executive Director of Reform for Illinois, thanks for your participation. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
Reading from my next guest piece, which I saw at thehill.com. The 2024 presidential race begins with two very unpopular frontrunners. Registered voters polled nationwide by Quinnipiac. They find 52% have an unfavorable opinion of Joe Biden. 54% have an unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump. Biden's problem is weak. Trump's problem has something to do with character and character flaws. So, what world do we live in? Generosity of spirit. They said that Ronald Reagan was a well-liked figure, even among those who disagreed with him politically. Those days are probably gone. So, is it about generosity of spirit or grievance politics? Let's start there with Bill Schneider, Professor Emeritus of Policy and Government, George Mason, author of a terrific book, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. Bill, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Thank you. I'm fine, thanks.
So could anybody emulate what Reagan was able to do when he was around, or is that behind us? That's in the rearview mirror, ash heap of history.
I don't know if it's the ash heap, but it is a remarkable period because he was a very popular president. He knew how to be president, even though he had no particular training while he was governor of California for 8 years. But he knew how to be president, and I don't think we've had anybody quite so knowledgeable and skilled at that since he was president. He said it was because of his training as an actor. In fact, he was asked, and he said, I don't know how anybody who's not trained as an actor could do this job.
Did Ronald Reagan at any point stand up in front of his fans, his audience, or Americans in general and say, I'm the biggest victim in American history?
No, he never treated himself as a victim. He really wasn't. He knew that. And the idea of presenting yourself as victimized is not a way to gain support. It makes you look sort of weak and a little bit pitiful. Trump plays on grievance politics. You know, when he declared himself a candidate for president, he listed all the people who were out to get him. It was a long list. I don't remember all the details, but he had a long list of people who the media and everybody else were out to get him. Grievance politics is Trump's thing. And a lot of people, particularly conservatives who are supposed to be his base, really don't appreciate that.
Well, let me take a issue with that. It seems like the Trumpian base, the base Trump voter, also feels as if the country's left them behind, and they're feeling a lot of grievance politics themselves, and they wrap themselves into Donald Trump as the man that's going to save them from everybody who's doing them wrong. When you start with 25 million people, that's not a bad business model, is it, politically?
Well, it is. If you want to get more people to join, you can't win an election with 25 million people.
Exactly.
Trump has a base. It's a limited base, and it's hard for him to go beyond his base. He has very little appeal to independents, no appeal whatsoever to Democrats, and it's hard to see how he can expand the base beyond the people you just described who share a lot of his grievances.
How do guys like DeSantis in particular, maybe Pompeo, maybe even Pence and others, how do they get to Trump out of the way without getting their heads cut off?
Well, they've got to depend on the voters to make the decision that Trump is yesterday's man. They want something new. They want something younger. DeSantis is only 44 years old. He'll be 46 in 2024. And that'll be quite a contrast with Joe Biden, who'll be 72 in 2024. The voters have got to decide that Trump is a man of the past, and DeSantis is the future of the Republican Party. The age difference is going to be very conspicuous in this election.
Yeah. If Biden, I want to get to that, but Biden will be 81 in 2024. DeSantis will be 46, as you wrote. On the Democratic side, no candidate has emerged to take on Biden. I think they're just giving him time to essentially decide to do the right thing. Newsom took himself out. Nobody's going to touch him because what, you know, the closest example is when Kennedy essentially somewhat challenged Jimmy Carter. But is it true that there's not a single sitting president that has been challenged for the nomination by his party, what, in American history or modern American history?
I know of two, not just one. You mentioned one. That was when Ted Kennedy ran against Jimmy Carter in 1980, and he didn't quite make it. The other one was Gerald Ford, who was not an elected president, but he became president when Nixon resigned.
Reagan.
Gerald Ford was challenged for the nomination. He wasn't renominated. He was never nominated until 1976. He was challenged by Ronald Reagan,
right.
The only election Ronald Reagan ever lost.
I guess what I should have said was, I should have said a sitting U.S. president has never lost the nomination to a competitor intra-party. Yes, Reagan challenged Ford and Kennedy challenged Carter, but they fell short. So do you see Joe Biden saying, look, the midterms are behind us now. I did historically very well considering my positions. And now I'm going to ride off into the sunset, get my card punched as the man that got Donald Trump out of the White House. See you later. Best of luck next time.
Well, I don't think so. I think he intends to run, and he intends to run on the basis of one principal achievement. He defeated Donald Trump. Democrats will never forget that. It's a very important thing for Democrats that they nominate someone who could defeat Donald Trump in case Trump is the nominee. But I'll tell you something. If it looks increasingly like Trump will not be the Republican nominee, then Biden is likely to go down with him because his main claim to the Democratic nomination is he can defeat Trump. If Democrats don't need to defeat Trump, they may look for someone new and someone younger.
Bill Snyder, speaking of age, what's the sweet spot in your mind for a presidential candidate, president?
Well, we've had the youngest so far was John Kennedy, although Teddy Roosevelt was younger when he became president. Mm-hmm. He wasn't elected. He became president when William McKinley was shot. But I'd say somewhere in the 50s is probably a good age for a president. Once you hit 60, it's sometimes difficulties can set in. I'd say someone in his 50s is probably the best shape to be president, or her 50s.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody on the Democratic side coming out that you think is, much like DeSantis, DeSantis could easily not tempt fate and he could just pass on 2024. He's young enough to do so. See anybody comparable on the blue side of the world?
Well, Gavin Newsom took himself out. The one that I thought would go much further and his career may now have stalled is poor Beto O'Rourke. He made a mistake. He ran against Ted Cruz for Senate and lost. Now he ran against Abbott for governor. A lot of people look at him and say he just can't do it. But running as a Democrat for governor of Texas or for a statewide office in Texas always looks like a losing position. Texas has not elected a Democrat statewide since 1994, since George Bush was in office and beat Ann Richards. So Beto O'Rourke looked very interesting and attractive and young, but he just hasn't been able to do it.
Bill Snyder, thanks for the analysis, the history lesson. Much appreciated. I like the book Standoff, How America Has Become Ungovernable. And we'll read more at thehill.com and have you back soon.
Thank you.
Happy holidays. That's Bill Snyder joining us here on Double Dales.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit. And you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Bill Cameron thought he was out and pulled him back in. WDL City Hall reporter emeritus, host of Take One, airing Sundays at 4 p.m. You can find it at WDLSAM.com. Well, he's here to talk about Alderman Ed Burke. He has decided not to stand for re-election for a 15th term. According to former Alderman Joe Moore, he'll go down as one of the most influential and powerful aldermen in the history of the city council. Never see the likes of him again. Ed Burke himself once said there's only three ways to exit the city council: the ballot box, the jury box, or the pine box. He is avoiding all three. Court filings this week reveal 9,000 recorded calls from the wiretap on Burke's phones and Ortiz, obviously. And he never had a good working relationship with the current mayor.
Anything further, Alderman?
Pardon?
Anything further?
Yes. Rule 9 also includes the same mistakes. Rule 12 includes the same mistakes. Rule 19 includes the same mistakes. Rule 20 includes the same mistakes.
Mr. Parliamentarian, and the mayor was having none of it. She shut him down shortly after taking office.
I'm not going to start off my term as mayor with the city council putting up with somebody who is just playing games for the sport of it. The people in the city expect us to do our jobs. They expect the government to actually work on behalf of the people and not have a Game of Thrones gamesmanship on the floor of the city council. I'm not having it.
54 years, the longest serving alder person in Chicago history. Let's start there with Bill Cameron. Bill, are you surprised that Ed Burke went out with a whimper and not a bang?
Well, not since they drew the new ward map. Based on the last census, Lightfoot made sure that the 14th ward, Ed Burke's ward, was a ward where he would have a tougher time getting reelected. And his ward organization ain't what it used to be. So I think that his decision to not run again is more like an anticipated ballot box, if you will. I think the odds were longer on him getting elected. And not so much about the indictment.
I was going to ask you that. What is worse for him overall, the federal charges, which a lot of alder persons have survived previously, even after being convicted, they're still on the ballot and they get reelected, or changing demographics? So it was really the redrawing of the maps and the changing demographics that did him in.
And there's something new on the indictment side of all this. I've been reading Adam Liptak, the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times lately. And he's saying that this Supreme Court looks askance at federal judges, federal courts, sending local and state politicians to prison. They ought to be doing that for federal officials and leave it to the states to do corruption cases against local politicians. And so with Burke deciding not to run, and with the Supreme Court, you know, looking askance at the feds prosecuting people like Alderman, maybe even Mike Madigan, maybe the time is better for Burke to make a deal in his case than it was before now.
Yeah, so the feds will lose a little bit of interest because he's not a sitting alderman.
That's right, and the Supreme Court might just reverse it.
Well, was Burke's alleged, perceived corruption, was that an open secret here in Chicago for years, the way he could double dip? I know that, you know, he would say, no, this is all legal. I was able to do that. I had my own law firm. Property taxes, what have you. I was also the chairman of the finance committee. No harm, no foul. But basically, was it an open secret that he was working both ends of the same system?
Yes. Nothing necessarily illegal. Both he and Mike Madigan have this property tax assessment reduction business. But it's a little surprising that he got caught on tape saying such damning things. That was the surprise part about it.
What was the quote, the banker hasn't been paid yet, or the bell hasn't been rung, or there's a verbatim in there.
Has the tuna been landed?
has the tuna been landed? Well, Danny Solis, I mean, is this, there's 9,000 recorded calls. They went on for months? It's got to be months, maybe even years. Are most of those based on the former zoning committee chairman, Danny Solis?
Yeah, I think they are, and they're not necessarily all of Ed Burke. They could be a lot of other people. But, you know, the other thing about Burke and, you know, working both sides is that over the years, we always suspected that Burke had a lot of proposals that we call fetchers. That is to say, a crooked politician puts a bill out there, which he really doesn't want to pass, but he wants to take it back if somebody will give him, in the special interest, money and, say, a campaign contribution to back off of it, to fetch a campaign contribution. Now, he can't prove any of this, but the aroma coming off many of his proposals had the fetcher scent to it.
Fetcher scent.
Did he always think that the fifth floor was his, essentially? You know, the old man, Richard J. Daley, he was a prodigy of the old man. And did he just think that it was a foregone conclusion he would be a mayor of Chicago, and then all of a sudden, here comes Richie?
Yeah, he did, in fact, run in that 89 election and then pulled out. And years later, when there was a transition, I asked him in an interview if he wanted to run for mayor again, and he has sworn no, which, you know, in the press room, we used to say, if he denies it, it must be true, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I think he was also comfortable in finance committee chairman, which was the second most powerful position in City Hall for many, many years.
Is he the best parliamentarian historically in Chicago?
Well, he certainly knew all the rules and bended them to his agenda. I'm trying to think if anybody knew the rules better than him. And I'd have to say the only one who did was Tom Keene, the professor, who was a city council finance committee chairman. And, of course, Richard J. Daley knew the rules really well up on the mayor's rostrum. So he's in an elite collection of people who knew the rules backwards and forwards.
In the Sun-Times today, I think this is Fran Spielman, she said, He initiated the ban on indoor smoking here, also mandated carbon monoxide detectors and defibrillators, also a ban on phosphates. What else do you recall from the long political legacy of Ed Burke that would be a positive?
A positive? All of my recollections of him being effective, if you will, were making the political deals to do things like over in the Central Committee of the party, slate all those judges, including his wife, to the appellate court in the Supreme Court. And she was a fine judge in both places, don't get me wrong. But his manipulation of the system is what I would say were his most effective achievements.
I know a person who was a associate judge, Cook County, who had to go see Ed Burke. And then he gave her a list of people that she had to go see to essentially make her bones. And without Ed Burke's okay on the list, she would have never made it.
Indeed, all those candidates for judge who went on bended knee to people like Ed Burke had to contribute, get this, $40,000 to the party to get slated and be on the palm cards. And this was justified as, you know, the cost of doing the politics, like the printing of this and that and the palm cards. But you literally, as a judge candidate, had to give dough and $40,000 worth to the party. How about that?
I was not aware of that, but I will ask this person who I talk with regularly if that was the case.
Okay.
Bill Cameron is here, WDL City Hall reporter emeritus, host of Take One. Did you notice we used Dave Brubeck's Take Five for your intro?
Yes.
Not David's original version, but still, Take Five for your show, Take One. Airs Sundays at 4 o'clock. You can find it on the podcast page at WDLSAM.com. Revisionist history. Had Harold lived, would he have reconciled with either or both of the Eddies?
No, because they were excellent whipping boys for each other. Verduliak was principally interested in political control and control of the money. Ed Burke, you know, lots of people said, and I was impressed by this, he was the one who was the racist, not Ed Verduliak.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I can't because it wouldn't be fair. I need to hang that on other people, mm-hmm. although in my experience with Ed over the years, of the two Eddies, if there was a one who was a racist, I'd be more inclined to believe that it was Ed Burke, not Edward Oleak.
Does he have any, well, I imagine he has many, but can you think off the top of your head, Bill Cameron, some of his political, essentially, offspring? Is Gary Chico in there? Gary Chico was his chief of staff, wasn't he?
He was, and he tried more than once to, you know, get elected mayor himself and couldn't do it, but he went on to be Chico and the Man with Paul Vallis running the public schools. And unfortunately, his law firm went bankrupt, so it's not all success on that disciple of Ed Burke. But, you know, there are many, and the bench is filled with them. And, you know how the system works in Cook County. They don't call it Crook County for nothing, John.
After 54 years and Ed Burke not standing for re-election, is it the official end of the machine or another nail in the coffin, or has it been dead and gone for a while?
Well, we still have John P. Daley sitting as chairman of finance at the county board, and he got reelected. So there is one Daley left. So you can't quite say the era is completely over. But I guess you can say that the era of a Burke-type alderman in the city council wielding so much control, that probably is over.
Who's the next closest?
Let me think. Probably Verdoliak.
And is Schaller still open on South Halsted, right next to John Daley's office?
You know, I don't know.
Huh. Somebody will find out. Somebody will know that. Well, Bill, thanks for popping on to the Magic Box. We appreciate it, sir.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Null. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.
So my next guest, he writes a newsletter, American Commonwealth. You can see that at Substack. He's a psychiatrist and political historian at Vanderbilt University. And I've not seen the book of essays yet, but I was intrigued by this because, as he writes, the most essential political reform needed in American democracy today, that is reform of our political parties to permit them to reject demagogues and authoritarians at presidential nominating conventions, that's necessary. The book is The Curse of Demagogues, Lessons Learned from the Presidency of Donald J. Trump. Let's welcome Dr. Eli Merritt to WLS. Doctor, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Nice to be with you, John.
Glad you have time to join me. I know the book is out today, The Curse of Demagogues. Before we get into how to change the manifestations of the party, I guess, don't the American people overall just deserve whomever they elect?
Well, I think the best answer to that question is that the most superior form of democracy that the world has experienced, that we know of since the ancient Greece 2,500 years ago, is representative democracy. And that is democracy where we have multiple layers of democracy. So we're adding more democracy, but at the same time, each of those layers acts as essential checks. Where democracy, as we all know, is very much about the will of the people, but without essential checks and balances, democracy would crumble, would fall apart. So the idea that I have suggested there of having the delegates at conventions have some power, essential power, do not elevate from their party individuals who clearly are not going to put the Constitution above themselves, who will not uphold free and fair elections. No political party should ever put forth a candidate under any circumstances who is not committed to free and fair elections and the peaceful transfer of presidential power.
But you also write that political parties must serve as gatekeepers to keep the demagogues out of the presidential pipeline. I guess that, but are we going to trust politicians to police themselves? I mean, isn't this all basically based on the primary system, which came into effect shortly after Watergate during the Carter years, where you took away the learned backroom politicians with their cigars and decided to hand it off to the people? Do we trust the people to make wise decisions?
Do we trust the people or do we trust their representatives? I guess that's the question that you're asking, right?
Exactly. In other words, if you can manipulate, if you're a politician and you have jerry-rigged the system and gerrymandered the districts so you just constantly get reelected, why would you change the primary system? All I have to do is win the primary, whether it's a blue primary or a red primary, I'm set.
Yeah, I understand that. And in some ways, the question of feasibility in our current political culture is less important than necessity. But if we do go back before 1972, when the nominating conventions, beginning with the Democratic nominating convention, began to bound their the delegates firmly to those who had been voted for within states. If you go back, what you find is all manner, with 50 states, we find all manner of permutations about how delegates were selected. But one of the best methods for selecting delegates is, in fact, where the people in each state vote for the delegates. That is democracy. And then the delegates in the convention do due diligence to make certain that the presidential candidates, the one that they end up elevating, is ethical, is not someone who is going to poison our democracy through demagoguery and bigotry and racism, misogyny. And as important to that, that's the demagogue part of it. But the authoritarian part of it is, I do believe that after what has happened over the past 7 years, we do need for political parties to erect litmus tests in which they, through their own means, they determine whether or not a candidate is going to abide by and uphold the Constitution, the oath of office. And I'll repeat what we've experienced so tragically recently is free and fair elections and the peaceful transfer of presidential power. Parties are very adaptable. They have changed remarkably over the past 150 years and how we nominate presidents. So I think this is a very hopeful method of introducing checks and balances on presidential nominating systems.
Where can we find your book of essays?
The essays are, I have it available for free as a PDF on my website.
Oh.
By the agreement of the 22 other writers, we agreed to make this available because it's important educationally. And then it's on Amazon as a print book and on numerous platforms as a very inexpensive ebook. Amazon, it will soon be available on Amazon as the ebook, but it's already available on Apple Books and other platforms like that.
Dr. Eli Merritt, psychologist and psychiatrist, and political historian at Vanderbilt. We've read him in New York Times, LA Times, Seattle Times, Chicago Tribune, and others. And good luck with the book of essays. I'm looking forward to it.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat because that should be your next question, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.